Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us they've gone from bad sentiment a few weeks ago to being bullish again. He checks out gold, crude, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. He also has a special offer for our listeners. Publisher of the Trends Journal, Gerald Celente, joins us from historic Kingston, New York, to discuss whether stock exchanges could hit new highs this year, the real rate of inflation, oil prices, and the possibility of a BRICS gold-backed currency. Editor of Rick's Picks, Rick Ackerman, examines the state of the stock market, why crude is falling, what happened to lithium mania, and whether the Chinese real estate crisis could spread here. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Maselgia. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to the show.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
Ross, do we have a special offer for our listeners?
Sure. We're going to do 25% off for annual subscriptions, new subscribers. That'll be good through U.S. Thanksgiving weekend, so 2 weeks from now. And, markets are off to the races here, and it's the time of year you want to participate. Clearly, seasonals have just kicked in a really bullish fashion. We went from very bad sentiment 2 weeks ago, and the markets have rallied depending upon the index, anywhere between 5% and 15% already. So we're off to the races at this point.
Anything in particular leading those markets?
Well, the names, the FANGs that had been the leaders in the spring, into the spring, I should say, because it was for an extended time. They've pretty much come back to life. Very good action there. If you take a look at the FANG index itself, that one has recovered about 80% of its losses that it had into the end of October, so that's quite good. The semiconductor index, the SMH, or the technology group, the XLK, both of those ETFs are just right now flirting with not just the highs that we saw a few months ago, but with all-time highs. So the market's gone through this pause and rotation effect. You've got to remember it was not that many weeks ago that it was the energies that had been carrying the market. And with oil having dropped off the way it is, the energy stocks have taken a back seat to the previous winners. And, at this point, we're looking at the S&P, which is trading around 4,400 right now. If we take a look at the depth of the correction that we had from the top and project up from here, I think you could be looking at a 4,700 level as a reasonable target into probably the early part of the year next year. And NASDAQ, the same type of thing. We're already back very, very close on the queues towards testing the summer highs. And a breakout there looks as though it could have a pretty nice run on the upside. We had looked for this last week and a half to have a good move off the low and have a pause and a possible correction Well, the pause was a grand total of, 3.5 days. That was it. And I would say that the Thursday low that we just saw during that consolidation is the one that the traders should keep an eye on. Yeah, it's probably where you would keep your stop loss, just underneath that. But let the market run. Just let it do its thing at this time of year.
Anything going on with gold?
That's the other side of the coin. There was, pretty good action in gold up until, 3 weeks ago now. And we've seen it now correct back. Just a perfect Fibonacci 38% from the October low, the early October low, to the high. That run was pretty much triggered by what was going on with the Hezbollah and with Israel. Ran out of steam, bit of a rolling top. Been hoping for a correction that would be of this magnitude. And the next week or so, I think, becomes pretty important here. We've got some oversold readings on gold into Thursday, Friday. And if they can turn the corner, if gold can manage to take out the highs of Tuesday, which is when we gap down, then I think it could be a way to the races on the upside. But for now, you want to be just looking at the golds themselves, maybe buy some of the hard dips in there, but the catalyst is going to have to be, from a technical perspective, a bit of a reversal here. We've had, I guess it is 5 days now with lower highs and lower lows, so you want to see it correct back more than one day. It's going to need to get back, as I say, through Tuesday's highs before I think you want to be too aggressive on that one right now.
What's going on with crude?
Crude oil, really happy with the action in here. We had topped with some nice upside exhaustion numbers and sort of tagged the top of that move. It was a first correction down to $82 and a bounce, recovered well off the initial bounce. And then when it came down to retest that $82 to $83 level, we had told subscribers that going through there, we would be looking for $76 and being a 62% correction of the rally from June, from the June-September move. So at this point, 76 or 75 and a half was just a perfect oversold low at the middle of the week. On Wednesday, we sent out a report on that one, and it looks as though we're getting a nice bounce. Looking at this is a tradable low at this point, something from here, maybe in the $81 to $82 range. And let's see what it does after it gets up there.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Quiet stretch over there overall. The dollar, the U.S. dollar, had been weak at the early part of the week and bounced back. You know, it's a trading range here. We've gone from 107 and change to just under 105 and then bounced back to 106. So right in the middle of the range by the middle of the week. Trend is trying to hold in here. The 20-week moving average managed to hold in reasonably well. But I don't know where the catalyst will be on the upside. But at this point, it's a flat trading range. And if we look over at the Canadian dollar, just the opposite action. You had the retracement rally from 72 up to about 73.5. That ran out of steam early in the week. And, we're back down to 72.5. So the Canadian dollar overall rallies are, should be sold as the trend just continues to be heavy to the downside. Not at an it's not moving dramatically, but just more in a methodical manner.
Is orange juice going to become more affordable to either have for breakfast or to mix with your fermented potato juice?
Yeah, well, it really does look like the mimosas might be, an affordable item at Thanksgiving or Christmas, at least. OJ has gone from, $1 to $4. Mm. And if that's not inflation, I don't know what isn't. But it broke out at about 2.5 out of sort of a broad channel going back over 2 decades. And then went to just pretty much exponentially to the top of the move at 4 and peaked out about 10 days ago. Seen its first little pullback and in a bounce here. But the seasonals on orange juice, and you got to remember, there's a futures contract there, and there's some options that could be played. The seasonals on those three previous major tops in the last 2 decades all topped out in November, December, and this one has been excessive enough on the upside that as soon as it starts to roll, and I think looking at that, maybe the first month with a lower low would be a trigger point, you should be looking at it giving back more than 50% of the gain that it's had, and that typically is what we've seen after these big runs, and it tends to stay under pressure right through until June or July. So that could end up being a long-term trade for anybody who is into the more exotic items and the soft commodities.
Ross, how can people sign up for your special offer?
They can go to our website at chartsandmarkets.com, and on the front page there will be a link for a 25% savings off the annual subscription.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
It was a pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Gerald Celente next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Gerald Celente, publisher of the Trends Journal, available online at trendsjournal.com. He's speaking to us from historic Kingston, New York. Gerald, it's been a while. It's great to have you back on This Week in Money.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a bit about the latest issue of the Trends Journal and how people can sign up for it?
It's packed with everything: geopolitics, economics, high-tech science, AI, technocracy, health, fitness, nutrition. We're giving people a magazine that they can't find anywhere else on the planet, and it's only $2.86 a week. So all you have to do is go to trendsjournal.com, trendsjournal.com, and our track record speaks for itself. You know, the trends are there. On the economic front, we had forecast back last November that the S&P 500 would go up at least 16%. It went up almost 20%. And then in July, we said the markets would go down. In September and October, early July, July 5th, we forecast that, and they did. And now we're forecasting what's going to happen next. So it's and then World War III has begun. Very, very sadly, and what's going to happen next with it. So it's, again, filled with AI, a whole section, technocracy, on and on.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any major trends developing that could end up in your Trends for 2024 edition due to be published in January next year?
Not yet. Not yet. We don't really get to that until in December, middle of December, when we really start looking back and understanding the current events forming future trends and which ones are going to be shaping in a new direction. So we'll get that out in early January. And by the way, trendsjournal.com is the website, trendsjournal.com. And if you go back to the top trends of 2023, one of them was Middle East meltdown. And word for word, we said what was going to happen, and here it is.
Could stock markets move higher into next year, 2025, and even 26?
They can go higher because we're forecasting they're going to lower interest rates in next year. They do it in the run-up to the elections all the time. The people running the country are the banksters. And the banksters are the head of the Federal Reserve is Janet Yellen, and her last job was the Fed head. So they're going to keep the power play, and they'll do everything they can. So they'll boost up the economy in any way they can artificially by lowering interest rates.
We hear groceries are up 76%. What do you think the real rate of inflation is?
You know, John Williams' shadow stats doubles the numbers that they're giving us. And again, they rigged inflation numbers back, you know, a while ago in the 80s and 90s. And so you mentioned food prices went up. Well, no, people stopped eating steak. Now they're eating chopped meat. So it's their budget and what they're spending. So it's a rigged game. It's a lie right in front of everybody's eyes.
One of the stats that they don't look at when they compile the CPI, apart from energy and housing, is the cost of taxes. And the Bank of Canada even admits that the Trudeau government's carbon tax has boosted inflation by 16% of the inflation rate.
Yeah. Again, what people call a government is nothing more than a crime syndicate. And it's run by the banksters in the military-industrial complex. And the drug dealers that they call Big Pharma. And the bankster bandits. Again, that's it. The bankster bandits. Oh, and high tech. Excuse me. I repeated bankster bandits twice. High tech, Big Pharma, military-industrial complex. And, it's right in front of everybody's eyes.
Have interest rates really peaked?
I believe they have. I don't think they're going to. We're forecasting, again, they're going to lower them. As the global economy is slowing down. You're looking at oil prices. And they should be skyrocketing now with the Middle East war going on over there. And then you look at the data, why are they going down? Well, because China demand is so low. And China's economy is going down big, and that's the second largest economy in the world. Look at their exports. They declined 6.4% in the last quarter, last month. So no, they're in trouble, and so it's a decline right in front of our eyes.
Mortgage rates have increased substantially, and so far, no housing crash. Any thoughts on why that's not happening?
This is different than the last housing bubble. The last one that happened back in early 2000s, up to the panic of 2008. You don't have a job. Got no money coming in, you're deep in debt, don't worry about it. Here, sign over here, it's a subprime mortgage. So this was a very different one. They had very, very low interest rates during the COVID war to artificially prop up the economy. And the people that bought the homes could basically afford them. What's going to bring down the prices when more and more people are laid off as the economy slows down. But we don't see a housing crash. We see the prices going down very, very little. And maybe even going up more if they lower interest rates enough. But again, there's the wild card, and that's the Middle East meltdown. Because if this war expands into Iran or other countries in the Middle East, you're going to see oil prices spike to above $130 a barrel, and that's going to crash equities and economies. And that'll bring down the housing market as well.
Do you think a gold standard could be brought in at $2,000 U.S. per ounce gold?
Oh, absolutely, and I think it'll come in with other countries. And the Americans aren't going to do it, but other countries are going to go onto the gold standard. And look at China. You know, China's economy is doing terrible. They're in rotten shape, and they're buying up gold like crazy. And that's when their yuan is very weak, and gold is dollar-based, and the dollar is very strong. And they're still buying up tons of gold. So yeah, that's where we see it going, only going higher. Again, there's going to be the ups and downs, and the gold is going down now because the word coming out that the Fed hasn't finished raising interest rates. But again, we say they're going to be lowering them again coming in 2024. And when the interest rates go down, the dollar goes down, and gold prices go up. It's as simple as that.
Earlier this year, there was talk the BRICS could bring in some kind of a gold-backed currency. It didn't happen. Do you think they eventually will?
I believe they will, because they're getting, again, when the dollar goes, when the dollar dies, there's going to be a call for a gold standard, because still the dollar is still very strong as a global, in the global economy. But again, when they lower interest rates, the dollar is going to dive. It's going to be the beginning of the death of the dollar. And yes, I see more and more countries going gold standard, and BRICS included.
Could we see an oil embargo, and what could that mean for the markets?
Well, yes, there can be very well an oil embargo like they did in 1973 as the Israel war keeps heating up. And that'll crash the equity markets and the economies. As I said, oil prices, Brent crude will hit over $130 a barrel, and that will destroy what's already being a destroyed economy.
How many countries need to be involved, and in how many areas, to be classified as a world war?
Oh, it doesn't make any difference. You know, it's about what will be the weapons used and what will be the outcome. And we're very concerned that with Ukraine losing the war, which we had forecast they would before it began, when all else fails, they do some very radical things. So they may attack a nuclear power plant, do false flag attacks, something very big that will be, you know, make the news. So it doesn't. And if the United States and Israel ramp up war against Iran, we could see the beginning of a very, very critical time ahead, because there's this thing called the Samson option. And it's Israeli, and it's basically if they lose, they go nuclear. And if they go nuclear, it'll be the end of life on Earth, basically. They asked Albert Einstein, you know, a guy that knew a thing or two about the atomic bomb, what kind of weapons will be used to fight the Third World War? He said, I don't know, but they'll be using sticks and stones to fight the fourth.
What's happening with China's economy?
It's gone. They ruined it with the 3 years of zero COVID policy. The damage that's been done is incalculable. You're looking at the youth unemployment rate. The last time they reported it, it was over 20%. Now they stopped reporting it. China was overbuilt before. You know, it was a booming economy that when they came into the World Trade Organization 2 weeks after 9/11 in 2001, their economy boomed. And when economies boom, you know, they bust if they, you know, everybody wants to get in on the game. So they overbuilt it. They pumped in countless trillions of yuans to keep pumping it up. And then with the 3 years of zero COVID policy, they destroyed their economy. The businesses have gone out of business, aren't going back into business. And the real estate sector has been way, way overbuilt. And now they're going down. We thought, we had forecast that China was going to be the 20th century was the American century, and the 21st century would be the Chinese century. But we had no idea that they would launch the COVID war and lock down the place for 3 years. No, it's a whole different game now. And again, you're looking at, again, why are oil prices down? Well, they're down because China's demand is way down. And again, a global slowdown. China's exports are down 6.4%, it's around there, 6.6, something like that, in the last month. So, no, China's in terrible, terrible shape. They also have a debt-to-GDP ratio of over 300.
You were bang on when you predicted that Russia would invade Ukraine, bang on predicting this trouble in the Middle East. What's going to happen between China and Taiwan?
They're going to take over Taiwan at some point. And as I say, when all else fails, they take it to war. and they get the people's mind off the failing economy by ramping up a war. So they're going to take it over, and it'll happen probably sooner rather than later. The more their economy goes down, the more they're going to ramp up tensions against Taiwan. And the United States is, and its allies are also ramping up tensions there, too, by keep sending fleets over there and running drills and all this other kind of stuff. So if we had China down in the Gulf of Mexico, wouldn't they be happy? America would love it. I mean, you know, what are we doing over there? So they're going to, the war machine is in charge, and they're going to keep ramping it up one side or the other.
In Canada and the U.S., mass migration with no room for the migrants. We have stories of people who immigrated to Canada legitimately deciding to bail out of the country because they can't find jobs or an affordable place to stay.
Again, it's going on globally. I mean, not globally, but in developed countries. I mean, look what just happened in Germany. They passed a strict anti-immigration law, and they're flooded. Everywhere you go, they're flooded. People have no idea. Tracking trends is the understanding of where we are, how we got here, to see where we're going. To how we got here, you go back to 2019, not ancient history. One of our top trends for 2020 was before the COVID war began, weeks before, there was a new world disorder. There were protests going on all over the world. The Yellow Vests in France, Algeria, India, South Africa, Lebanon, Peru, Chile, all over. People taking to the streets in protest of lack of basic living standards, crime, government corruption, violence, flooding out of the countries. Protesting, and then the COVID war began. Get back in your house. You can't protest anymore. Get back in there. So now, again, the economies were going down before this. Germany in 2019 was a fraction away from officially going into recession. So now, with the COVID war and the damage it's done to billions of lives and livelihoods is incalculable. So people are escaping from all over the underdeveloped nations that have suffered so greatly from the 3 years of COVID war. And it's not going to stop unless the governments do something to really stop immigrants from coming into their countries, which they're now doing again in Germany and a number of countries are pushing more and more populist movements to stop the flow of refugees.
Could we be in for an early 80s type recession or worse?
Oh, this is going to be much worse. This is going to be the worst in modern history. Again, everything should have crashed during the COVID war, and they pumped in countless trillions of dollars. Zero and negative interest rate policy stayed in place in Europe when zero in America and other countries. And they artificially propped it up. They built a bubble that's unprecedented, and it's going to crash.
Argentina has inflation running around 144%, Turkey 74%. Any chance of hyperinflation hitting North America?
Yes. When they, it depends. Again, if the Israel war heats up and oil prices spike above $130 an ounce, yeah, you're going to start seeing really, really rising inflation.
How can people sign up for the Trends Journal?
Oh, very simple. Just go to trendsjournal.com. Trendsjournal.com. It's the only magazine that gives you history before it happens.
Gerald, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Gerald Celente, publisher of the Trends Journal. He was speaking to us from historic Kingston, New York. Gerald, what makes Kingston so historic?
This is the third Dutch settlement. There are more pre-Revolutionary War stone buildings here than anywhere else in the country. I own three on the most historic four corners, the only place in America with pre-Revolutionary War stone buildings on each corner. The other one is a museum. And it was the first capital of New York State, and the British burnt it down. The Constitution that was written for New York State here in Kingston, over 70% of America's Constitution comes from this Constitution. And John Jay, the famous Supreme Court judge, was a judge over here. So there's a lot of history here.
Gerald, thanks again.
Thank you.
My guest has been Gerald Celente. Coming up, Rick Ackerman, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. He's speaking to us from South Florida. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, thanks for inviting me on, Jim. It is always a pleasure, and I'm feeling oracular today, so I hope you have some good questions.
Well, first off, Rick, can you tell people a bit about Rick's Picks and how they can sign up?
Well, we have a couple chat rooms. One is a trading room that's geared to actionable trades, and we haven't had a bad week, really, and as long as I can remember, we've had just trades that come up in real time, and there's a list of touts that gives people a good overview of the market so that you can kind of calibrate your own ideas. And right now, if you go to rickackerman.com and you click on free trial up at the top, you don't even have to leave a credit card number. You can just sign up. You'll get all the amenities for 2 weeks.
Rick, will the stock markets reach a new high by the end of the year?
No, I don't think so, but certain stocks will. And in the past, we've talked about how Apple is a great proxy for the market. And if you have a chart that says Apple is going higher, that means that there's no bear market on its way. And that's irrespective of whether it's September and everybody's looking for the October quote-unquote surprise. But Microsoft is just as good a bellwether. And it's currently, as we speak, trading for $367. And I can pretty much guarantee you it's going to $430. So at the intervening $63, there's no possibility of a bear market. Microsoft also, it may even be a better bellwether than Apple, because if we do hit the skids and the global economy goes in the crapper, we may buy far fewer iPhones. The replacement cycle on iPhones may go out to 3 or 4 or 5 or 7 years, but Microsoft will still be selling its software on a subscription basis. They've done a pretty good job making everything subscription. That wouldn't be great in and of itself, but they've also upgraded their tech support. So even I don't feel so bad when Microsoft duns me every year for the annual billing. It's overall not a bad service, and the Windows platform is pretty solid.
What's the deal with crude falling, even though a global war could break out at any time?
Well, the crude oil market is really a good example of how all markets are manipulated. You know, even from my days on the options exchange floor, where I could say that any order that came into the trading pit was front run. There was and still is no such thing as just a legit order, some bullish buyer who's matched with a bearish seller. It just doesn't happen in nature. But crude is manipulation on another order of magnitude. It's manipulated as part of a financialized economy where oil winds up being a source of collateral. So oil tends to swing with perceptions of international money flows and, I guess for that matter, whatever the central banks are doing. So if you get this idea that crude should be moving up on news of crisis headlines that say that the Middle East could erupt into nuclear war any day now, which it actually could, you know, it wouldn't take any more than a scattershot, a missile roughly aimed at one of the carriers that's sitting out there in the Mediterranean, and that would start quite a war. But the oil market, rather than acting nervous, it just loves it because everybody, you know, everybody's a bear, and they've already done their selling in crude, so it's crude becomes much easier to manipulate by the forces that do the manipulating. Crude's up pretty good today, $1.50 on the NYMEX futures, and just kind of in its own world, really, and like so many other things, the movement, price movement, just doesn't relate to anything you read about or anything you might imagine or any kind of logic that connects up with the real world with news. So crude, my target is 117. It's currently trading at 77. I'm somewhat less inclined to think it's going to get there because the last spike in crude that we had, it missed taking out a high. The actual high on the last move up was not about $93, maybe a little less than that. And that failed to exceed a high that was made in June of 2022 at around 94. So if this pop to 117 were going to occur, I would have expected this this last peak, which occurred, when was it, the end of September, to get above that June 2022 peak. So I think crude will be somewhat docile in a range of 70 to maybe $65 to $90 with the wild card that if something really happens, and I mean it would take a mushroom cloud billowing over the Middle East to actually scare crude higher. Unless that happens, we're going to see crude trading in a range.
Why isn't lithium doing better if EVs are supposed to be the wave of the future?
Got a lot of bad press. You know, I'm tempted to say lithium is doing so poorly because I made a substantial commitment to one particular stock. The symbol is LITOF, and I should have taken the money and run when it popped after I initially bought it. But it looks like it's headed to zero right now. And, you know, there are any number of substitute elements, you know, there are substitutes for lithium in the EV battery technology. And, of course, they're working in all areas, really, even with the, you know, microchips. They're looking, actually they're going the other way there. They're trying to create a diamond interface on microchips. Mm. But there are enough substitutes for lithium in experimental technologies now for making electric vehicles lighter and batteries cheaper and less resource dependent. So lithium's really, there are too many possible stories there and substitutes developing for lithium in the EV.
Now, governments are trying to legislate a move to electric vehicles. British Columbia saying they won't allow the sale of traditional engine vehicles after 2035. Are governments prematurely pushing this technology without enough infrastructure in place, enough charging stations, enough electrical generation, and so on?
Well, we've seen a lot of I won't call it publicity. It's too respectable. You've got a growing body of facts that has really gotten it into Joe Sixpack's head that there's so few advantages really to alternative sources of power, most particularly wind power. You know, wind power looks like the whole concept, which was being pushed by some very, very big contractors to put wind generators out in the ocean off New Jersey, among other places. And people are starting to realize that to put up a wind tower in the ocean and sink the pilings and even to maintain it when it's out there 20 miles at sea, it's a very expensive project. It's, starting to realize that wind power will never be competitive other than with huge subsidies. So the whole green idea, that's why the politicians like to talk about 2035. Nobody's going to be held responsible in any way if that prediction doesn't pan out. But I think it is predictable that because you really can't, if you take a pie that shows you the allocation of different fuel sources, then it's very hard to change that pie much. And if your wind generators are down there, whatever, 3.7% of that much, not even that much, it's very hard to kind of move to reallocate energy to develop technologies that would put that at 10%. So don't trust any prediction that you hear about mandating electric vehicles, because really the world's on to the fact that it takes power that comes from somewhere to run them.
Yeah, and of course I'm looking at some statistics concerning electric vehicles. They take 5 times more petroleum to make an electric vehicle than a standard one. Electric vehicles use a tremendous amount of copper. Some 83 kilograms, 183 pounds of copper goes into the average electric car. That's 277% more than a standard vehicle. Where's all this copper going to come from?
Yeah, exactly right. And it's interesting to me that the story just kind of got out there. I don't know that there's a hugely well-endowed public relations fund or source of where these news stories come from, but that one, just sort of deconstructing the electric vehicle in terms of the environmentally depleting things that go into it, that story is like all over the place. And it just kind of got out there because the facts were too compelling. It didn't even need a PR push, sort of an anti-environmentalist. I don't know. I'm not anti-environmental myself. But anyway, the story has sort of grown. It's mushroomed organically.
Yeah, I also saw an article that electric cars may become uninsurable because even a minor accident can damage the battery pack that costs 10 to 15 grand to replace.
Yeah, and that cost could go up considerably if they start incorporating elements of the power system, the battery, in the chassis of a car. You know, that was one of Elon Musk's advanced concepts. But that was one idea as to how to lower the weight of the EV, was to incorporate the battery into the frame of the car.
Now, something you never hear about, though, are cars run by compressed air. When I was in England 20 years ago, the front page headline said, electric car does 80 kilometers an hour for 80 kilometers. Now, that's 50 miles an hour for 50 miles. But you don't see anybody pressing for compressed air cars, and they're technically feasible. And I could see the car being made out of just one big compressed tube to keep the air. And when that runs out, you just swap out compressed air bottles at the service station. So now there's something that would be environmentally sound.
Although you're going to need power to compress the air. and the tanks, the compressed air tanks, weigh something, not as much as a bunch of batteries. But if you're going to compress something, I'm kind of hoping it's hydrogen. And hydrogen is one source of power, even for cars, that has a pretty good, a pretty strong consensus behind it. And it's only the technology that has to come up to the hopes and expectations before we see it.
Yeah, we had a hydrogen-powered transit bus in Vancouver, and the bus driver went around back. There's a tap sticking out of the bus, and he takes out a glass of water and drinks it. He says, that's the exhaust from my bus. It's just water, a water tank. I said, he says he can drink it if he's thirsty, and he drains the tank at night and uses the water to flower or water his flowers. So there's a nice environmental experiment. But you don't want it going out in water vapor, because that captures more heat than carbon dioxide does, 10 times more. Otherwise, you get the Venus effect. By the way, why is the economy we experience in our daily lives weaker than the one the government tells us is going on?
Because everything the government tells us is bull. And the story, you know, these fantastic stories about 3 or 4% growth, whatever. You read that, and then you read, well, Citibank is laying off 10% of its workforce, and this, you know, this car manufacturer is laying off, and it seems like a lot of big businesses are laying off in a big way, and you kind of wonder, well, what are the offsetting jobs that are being created? But if you sort of look around in your own life, talk to friends with businesses, then you already know that they're all working pretty hard. Just to pay the bills. You know, it's not like even successful businesses are keeping up with the cost the owners are experiencing in their lives. So you know, you just don't, you can't see the signs of a strong economy, and probably the most visible sign of weakening is that the retail sector, the brick and mortar retail, keeps shriveling up. And you have to assume that whatever shriveling occurs, the only offset is Amazon. So, but the reason it's relatively easy for the spinmeisters to float this story, have it mildly believed, well, not even, no, I don't think so, but to at least say we're having 3 or 4% growth, is that the growth is mostly in, we still have asset inflation captivating the proletarian mind. So when you look at the Dow and you see it's up at 34,000 within, let's say, not spitting distance, but certainly pitching wedge distance of all-time highs, when you look at that, you think, well, I guess maybe the economy is not too bad. You know, if the economy were so bad, you know, how could the Dow industrials be trading within, you know, let's say a few months, couple months move of new record highs. But you have to remember that it's only there because you've got a lot of hot air supporting it. It's just a big hoax. But subliminally, we're all kind of aware the stock market is not collapsing. Ergo, the economy is at least okay.
Well, Canadian Tire, huge retailer in Canada, laying off 3% of its staff. And we've seen high-tech companies laying off staff as well.
Interesting. You know, when Musk took over Twitter, he kind of, it established as fact that you can take these big bloated companies that have billion-dollar payrolls, and you can sort of reduce the staff from 7 or 8,000 to 10 people, and they can get the job done. So that, I think that's true of most high-tech companies. It would be true of Facebook and Google. And, of course, there's a lot of capital invested in those companies. They're huge. And, you know, it's pretty easy to see that they will eventually deflate. The stock value will deflate, and it will be a more honest reckoning of what the company does, what they're worth, and how many employees they need and all that.
What's the problem with gold?
Well, it's in the ugliest, worst, most frustrating bull market you could imagine. Gold is a... when I was talking about the crude oil market being manipulated, well, bullion is that times 10 because the supply of it compared to the supply of energy is relatively finite. So gold and silver wind up being easier to manipulate by the powers that be that happen to be the bullion bankers, kind of in concert with their friends in government. So gold and silver, they're definitely in a bull market, but the biggest players would rather that gold not take off right now. You know, they're so busy accumulating, and that's a quiet story. You know, usually we discuss gold and silver in terms of its popularity among retail investors, but the real story is more in what the central banks are doing. And I get the feeling every sovereign entity on earth is trying to lay in a pretty good inventory of gold before they let her rip. And so gold in the meantime will fluctuate based on the Punch and Judy show that goes on between the European Central Bank and the Fed and the Bank of Japan. And those are kind of the big forces that allow gold and silver to be buffeted around, or more to the point, manipulated within a range until they, I'll use that expression again, until they let her rip. And gold, from a psychological standpoint, is at a very crucial place for letting her rip, because once it takes off above 2,000 and it becomes kind of a popularly appreciated fact that 2,000 is now support rather than resistance or a stumbling block, then even the powers that be are not going to have much control over it. It's just going to be headed into the ozone, probably to at least 2,500 initially, gold currently trading 1941. So let's just say gold is it's in a bull market, but it's being heavily manipulated and suppressed at the 2,000 level, pursuant to this goal of just when all the central banks have spent enough time glutting themselves and building their own store of gold, then they're going to let it go.
Inflation in Argentina, it's running at 140%. They project it could be up to 200% by the end of the year. Turkey is over 70%. Any chances of hyperinflation hitting in North America?
No. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so. And that there are about 20 ways for me to address that. But one way would be just a question. Do you think that your mortgage lender is going to let you settle your $280,000 mortgage in snide paper and bogus bills? You would just take out your wallet and pull out $300,000 bills and pay your banker and get $20,000 in change. That ain't going to happen. You know, the hyperinflation implies that all lenders are going to get stiffed. And you can imagine that reasons why that's just not going to happen.
Have Treasury yields peaked?
I would say possibly, but I don't think so. You know, the bonds are in a little bit of a rally. If you follow the ETF version of bonds, kind of, then we need a pretty good rally to get this thing out of trouble. You know, just for starters, the recent low on TLT, which tracks the 20-plus year treasuries, the recent low was 82.42. And the rally over the last several weeks has gotten it above a peak that was made in mid-October at 88.47. But it really... in order to suggest that this rally has got some sticking power, the rally has to continue without any significant pullbacks on the weekly chart, it has to get up to, the price would be 97.06. So that's a 9-point rally from here, little more than, about a 10% rally. So, and that's just to get it to the point where you would say, you know, this looks promising. But, for sure, somewhere down the road, there's a flight to safety and a flight of global money into the haven. And I use that word loosely, the safe haven of U.S. treasuries. And I would think it'd be more pronounced now, really, because what reason is there to be in the stock market except to play this last gas that would accompany a move in Microsoft up to that target I gave you later? So I don't think we've made a bottom, and I think yields could eventually push up on the 10-year into the range, six percent, somewhere between 6 and 7. And the recent high on rates was, let's call it 5%. So we've come back down, currently trading 4.6% on the 10-year, but I think we've got another push up.
The overall bond market, how would you describe it?
Well, it's somewhat normalizing. You know, if you take the spreads between any two durations, they're less inverted or becoming uninverted, and supposedly that's really when the yield curve inversion pans out as a recession. You know, it's not when the inversion itself occurs, it's when rates normalize. So they're normalizing now. If we're having a recession, though, it will have to wait until Microsoft gets up to that target. And I don't want to have to pull up a chart of Apple to tell you what the corresponding number is, but yeah, I think we've got a little room there.
Do you think the real estate crisis caused by Evergrande and Country Garden in China could spread here?
It doesn't have to. It's already here in spades. You know, we talked about there was a building in San Francisco on Spear Street, south of Market. That's pretty good. That's a pretty good location. You know, it's really not quite the heart of the downtown, but it's an expensive piece of land. And there was an 11-story office building there that that was, until a few months ago, carried on the books. It was $140 million for tax purposes. And the last sale before it appreciated somewhat was at about $110 million, I think it was. So somebody came along and they bought it for $40 million. So that basically announced the crash has already occurred. It really has, and it's only a matter of time before all the neighbors of that building get marked down as well. The only thing that the commercial real estate area, the only thing it's got going for it, same thing for residential, is there's not enough transaction volume to give you a good price. But you can bet that $40 million sale at the margin will have drastically reduced the value of every commercial property in San Francisco. And of course, you don't need Evergrande and the Chinese influence to affect other things going on in San Francisco. You take the huge building. It's beautiful. They have an atrium on a fourth or fifth floor, and you can see the billions that went into the construction. It's all like really top quality. But even the titular tenant, Salesforce, they don't have enough. They can't fill that building. So they've sublet quite a bit of it. So if Salesforce.com can't even occupy its own building, you can imagine how bad things are. And of course, that repeats. It's that same phenomenon is present in virtually every big city with big office buildings. It's a little worse in San Francisco because the fabulous city itself, it managed to sustain inflated commercial real estate prices long beyond the point where people realized that San Francisco was going to hell in a handbasket. So, we've got fully loaded into the pipe, impacted into the pipeline, a commercial crash of epic proportions. And the same thing will happen in residential. It's going to make the 2007-08 experience look relatively mild, because even though residential only lost about 32-33% of its value on average across the U.S. then, I think that the next time will be the fulfillment of something I've been predicting for more or less forever, and that is a 70% crash in residential, but with even more severe price contraction in second homes, vacation homes. And you've got a kicker right there that everybody can see, and that is the fact that all these private equity companies and other companies like Zillow, who bought real estate and a lot of spec real estate bought by Airbnb hopefuls, they're about to get crushed. And even when the Airbnb properties come on a market, or let's say not, they won't necessarily come on the market, but whatever their use, it will seek out its market value, whether it's rented or mortgaged or underwater on a mortgage or whatever. So we've got so many things. It's sort of a perfect storm there that is building to take down residential and commercial real estate.
Yes, we just had the bankruptcy of WeWork.
Right, and a great, that's another huge overhang on the market, because WeWork's problem was that they acquired so many leases. They have so many properties there that they were going to turn into, you know, ping pong, air hockey offices for the millennials, who now, of course, you know, a lot of those tech jobs have disappeared. So WeWork had a huge commitment, and for them to have to disgorge to deal with all the leases that they've got for office space that they've never rented, that's just one more factor that you can add to the perfect storm that's coming in real estate.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
The only thing that's sort of dynamically interesting is the Middle East. You really can't keep a close eye on the treasury markets or the gold markets. They're infinite, they're vast, but you really don't know what's going on. But in the Middle East, we at least get the video footage of rockets exploding and all that. And so far, the worst that anybody could have imagined hasn't happened. That would be, Hezbollah joining full tilt, and Iran, whoever, taking a pot shot at an aircraft carrier. But that's a real game changer. It could potentially happen today. You know, we could have this conversation, and sometime later in the afternoon, there's an escalation in that conflict that will have implications for the whole world. So even though Wall Street just kind of shrugs, it's blithely unconcerned about the Middle East, or at least it pretends to be, that's something we should all be concerned about.
Rick, can you remind people again how they can sign up for your newsletter?
Go to rickackerman.com, and up top there's free trial. You don't have to leave any credit card information, and I do have a special deal for, there's a course that I offer that's at a greatly reduced price right now, but if you subscribe for a year and you don't make back your subscription cost with some of these layup trades that are posted in the chat room all the time, I'll refund your money.
Rick, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Well, I appreciate your inviting me on, Jim. It's always a pleasure to get together.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website, rickackerman.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Gerald Salente, and Rick Ackerman. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Masalgia. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. My guest is Zarko Masalgia. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Recyclico. Welcome back to Company Showcase.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
What's the latest at Recyclico?
Well, on October 31st, we held our AGM at our office, and we had a good in-person turnout, and I was able to put some faces to the name. Shareholders voted their proxy before the meeting, and our lawyer, along with our transfer agent, reported the votes. The voting did go in favor for the appointment of our auditor, incentive plan, and most importantly, our change of business from a mining issuer to an industrial technology or life science issuer, especially now that we are called Recyclable Battery Materials. There was a recommendation earlier before the AGM to the board for a new director, and we proposed to increase the number of directors to 6, but that was voted against at the AGM. However, thinking about it, I do agree that having an odd number of directors avoids any potential deadlocks in voting. Before the AGM, Ed Skoda stepped down, and Shaheen Ali, who is also our CFO, decided to step down as director to make room for the recommended person. I just want to make this clear because I've been getting lots of questions about this. But Shaheen Ali will remain as the CFO of the company. Shaheen is a valuable part of the team, and I don't see this shift having any impact on day-to-day operations. With that said, we're excited to welcome Richard Sadowski and Rod Langtry to our board, bringing with them a wealth of business expertise and fresh insights to help guide our future direction. But I also want to just address the obvious. Our stock price has seen better days, and understandably, our shareholders are eager for a turnaround. In response, our rejuvenated board is engaging in comprehensive discussions to chart a strategic path forward, and our focus areas include a number of things. You know, one being our existing project pipeline, so evaluating our current projects, prioritizing the top joint venture prospects for optimal growth, looking at capital market engagement, so enhancing our communication with the capital markets to ensure our company's mission and value propositions are clearly understood by investors. Innovation leadership, so, continuing our commitment to an innovation-driven approach to keep us at the forefront of the industry. We're looking at government funding, so actively seeking government funding opportunities to support our continuous innovation and scaling efforts. In terms of our, also looking at financial health, so maintaining our commitment to strategic investments and prudent financial management to sustain and grow. Exploring new markets and opportunities to broaden our impact and footprint, looking at team development, so focusing on empowering and equipping our team to meet future challenges with confidence, and of course, embracing adaptability, so enabling us to swiftly respond to market shifts and emerging trends, as especially in this market, we're constantly seeing these shifts and we have to be adaptable. But our collective efforts are aimed at not just stabilizing, but elevating our company's performance and delivering value to our shareholders and ensuring long-term success. So I am confident in what is ahead. However, we're not just strategizing about our future. We're also going to be actively shaping it. And our first joint venture in Taiwan is a prime example of this, serving as a future full-scale commercial demonstration of our technology. And that work is underway on multiple fronts, those being, you know, the joint venture setup. So our JV partner, Zenith, has successfully incorporated the JV entity, which is a significant milestone. And that incorporation is in Taiwan. The next steps are going to include numerous business formalities, so including tax registration, which is already approved. Currently, the JV is also navigating import-export registration and factory registration with the relevant authorities, and just laying the groundwork for operational efficiency. On the other front, you know, technical documentation and PNID development, you know, that's on the technical front. We're working on that comprehensive step-by-step documentation of our process. The documentation, this documentation is going to be transformed into a PNID. And a PNID is not just a diagram. It's an essential tool that outlines the intricacies of our plant's process flow, including piping, valves, instruments, and process equipment. It's also critical for planning, maintenance, safety, compliance, and training personnel on the operation of the plant. On another front, well, we have collaboration with our suppliers and engineers. So, you know, armed with the detailed documentation, we're going to be, you know, we're collaborating closely with equipment suppliers and engineers. Our focus is on constructing modular units locally. So this approach doesn't just offer us greater control over the construction process. It also enables us to oversee the quality and efficiency of the build. And then our module, the module construction strategy is key also to our agility. So unlike a traditional project, you know, the way they approach it is it requires a complete site preparation before any construction can begin. Whereas our modular units allow construction to occur simultaneously with site preparation. Now, this parallel progression means quicker deployment and faster commissioning once the units are transported to the Taiwan plant location. And the module approach isn't just about speed. It's about adaptability and scalability with modular units. So with modular units, we can rapidly respond to changing market demands and scale our operations efficiency. This strategy is a game changer, reducing both time to market and operational costs, giving us a significant competitive advantage. Lastly, I'm excited to share that next week I'll be attending the Benchmark Minerals Intelligence event. This is a significant gathering in our industry, known for its excellent turnout and discussions. At the event, we'll be engaging in a series of meetings that are linked to our company's growth and direction. This includes connecting with industry, with leaders in the industry. I'll be meeting with battery and EV companies to discuss potential collaborations and stay up to date on the latest trends, collaboration with our peers as well. So my schedule also involves discussion with fellow battery recycling companies by sharing industry insights and exploring potential partnerships. I will also be speaking with reporters to share a company's vision, achievements, and perspectives on the future of battery recycling. And lastly, I'll be meeting with finance groups who are also on the agenda to explore financial strategies that align with our company's objectives. Now, I think, you know, the Benchmark events is always an opportunity for us to build partnerships, strengthen existing ones, and stay tuned to the, you know, pulse of the industry. So yeah, I look forward to representing our company and bringing back valuable insights and connections, and that will drive our mission forward. So yeah, please stay tuned for updates.
Zarco, for people new to Recycleco, what's the company all about?
Recycleco is a battery materials company focused on lithium-ion battery recycling and upcycling, taking battery waste and upcycling it to a battery-grade product, which is a cathode precursor and lithium chemical that can go back into new battery production and use.
Where are you traded?
We're traded on the TSXV under the ticker symbol AMY, on the OTCQB on AMYZF, and the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under 2AM, And you can find more information on us at www.recyclico.com.
Zarco, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been Zarco Masalgia, Chief Executive Officer of Recyclico. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on November 10th.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.